Today, seven bells of the afternoon watch. And I am near Cleveland, Ohio, whereas last week I broadcast from London. And the reason that I am in Cleveland is that when I told you last week that my brother-in-law, Mary's oldest brother, was on the binnacle list and was very ill, he did not make it. And he died during my flight home from London. And I talked to his other brothers. I consider myself a brother as well. And when Mary and I got together, all of the Redmonds became Captain Joe's people. And I am Captain Joe to them, as well as to one or two others of Captain Joe's people all over the world. So I'm in Cleveland, and my day has been one of high emotion because I went to the funeral, and then I went to a Catholic cemetery that where Brian has now gone back into the earth from which we all came. Cleveland, for me, is a mixed relationship. On the negative side, in the wintertime, the wind comes howling across Lake Erie, and it boils itself right down that plaza in front of the federal building, and it is just brutally, brutally cold when it's a really hard winter. On the other hand, when I had my north wind up in the lakes, and I was moving convoys of ore boats from the minehead in Duluth down to the mill towns on the south shore of Lake Erie, I would form the convoys of empties or ships in ballast right at off the Cleveland breakwater. I did this for a couple of reasons. One of them was that it was a really good place. It was flat ice, and it was there was plenty of room to get everybody rounded up. The other reason was that my boss could watch the proceedings from his office window. And there's a wonderful photograph that was taken of my north wind acting like a very large, very red sheepdog, rounding up about 13 or 14 ore boats in ballast, getting them ready to make the trip back up through the Great Lakes system and to the port of Duluth, which is where they load the iron ore called taconite. So and I would also fuel in Cleveland. I would have fuel brought down in tank trucks. So it was a port of a very short rest period. And it was a place where I could easily round every. Well, it wasn't anything easy about it, especially if I had some of the more irascible captains who objected to being told what to do by essentially the convoy commodore, who was I. And on the other hand, the winters there can be absolutely brutal. Anyway, that's why I am in Cleveland. And after I had learned that Brian had died, and his crossing of the bar was a very difficult one, and it was really hard. And so I realized that none of the other West Coast brothers were going to be able to go to the funeral, and I was able, and I was more than willing, and so I did it. Which brings me to a point about travel, and I'm going to bring this in now before I get to the binnacle list. And that has to do with travel. I have been doing quite a bit of travel in the last year. Once travel loosened up a little bit where we could do it without hazarding ourselves life and limb through the virus, I started traveling, and one of the objectives of this particular exercise was to go to Captain Joe's people who either could not or chose not to travel themselves. And I found and I discovered that an enormous amount of good came out of all of this, not just for my own selfish, what I call healthy selfishness, not only for my own selfish objectives, but also that it has meant a great deal to the people that I go and see. Now, I have a wonderful capacity for self-deception sometimes, and maybe I am deceiving myself, but I don't think so. For example, last Thanksgiving, I made a trip to my sister and my brother-in-law in Vermont for Thanksgiving. And that visit was the catalyst for the first family gathering at Thanksgiving dinner that they had had in 2 years. And then we all went out for a big dinner in a traditional New England inn. And that was the first time they had been out for a meal in over 2 years. And so I believe that these visits have a good thing. But they've also been a good thing for me because, for one thing, the exercise that I get in moving around the airports. So all of this is to say that if you are thinking about doing some traveling and you are deterred by whatever it is that is deterring you, then this is my hope and my wish, not my command. I can't command that from the captain's chair, that you will actively consider going out. And if there's a family situation that possibly you have been dodging dealing with, or there are people who with whom you have been close before, but somehow or other have dropped off of your scope, or for some other reason, think it through and take on board my hope that you will go ahead and reopen your horizons, especially with people who really would like to see you, would like to spend some time with you, and that you have taken the trouble and the time to go to them. I will point out to you that the airports have gotten much larger. The airport last night, I arrived in Cleveland Hopkins at midnight, and there was a long stretch from where the airplane puked us out onto the gate to baggage claim. It was about 8 nautical miles, and when we got to the sign that said, and I did take a couple of stops to admire the view and a couple of little rest stops on the way, but I refused to ride in one of those wheelchairs that's pushed around by somebody else, or one of those electric carts that run up and down the passageways. I refuse to do that. So that means that I hike along, and I'm finding that it is getting easier and easier as the airports get bigger and bigger. Last night at Cleveland Hopkins, I thought that I had achieved the nirvana of baggage claim, and it turned out that it was closed that for the night, and please go to the next exit, which was another 3 nautical miles downstream. A long, long hike. But I find that they become easier and easier, and so will they for you as well. The other thing is that the aircraft in which you fly, some of them are of such antiquity that the airworthiness certificate is printed on parchment. I flew on one of those last night. And conversely, some of them are brand new and have growing pains going on. But all of these things are mitigated by, almost without exception, the flight attendants, both male and female flight attendants, are really, really working hard. They're really heaving around to do a great job. And so I urge you, if you are reluctant to take a journey, to take a trip, and especially one where you would be seeing people that you haven't seen for a while who would love to see you, now's the time to do it, because we never know. It is not given to us to know the day nor the hour, and how well do many of us know that. So yesterday, coming from SeaTac to ORD into Chicago, one of my least favorite airports in the entire world, ORD, the airline code for Chicago, and we were on final, and the aircraft commander elected to take a wave off. And that has not happened to me very often in my traveling career. I have been in Coast Guard aircraft where we flew touch and goes and things like that, but very seldom have I been. This, I think, is maybe the second or third time that I've been in an aircraft where they did a go-around. And you can feel the tension in the cabin when the aircraft is almost ready to touch it down, and then all of a sudden the aircraft commander puts on the throttles and climbs out, and everybody is looking around with the, whoa, what is going on? And because the flight deck crew has got a lot of things going on all at once, they don't come and inform the passengers until much later. So be not concerned should that happen to you. It is not all that common, but it is a well-practiced procedure, and I am assured of all of this by my aviation advisor, Captain Truman O'Brien, who, by the way, is not engineering for me today. Jurist Dr. Craig Bellis, my counselor friend, is on the panel today, for which I give him many thanks. The binnacle list, of course, is bereft of my brother-in-law, Brian, and there are a number of people on it who have been undergoing tests and surgeries, and it is my wish, my desire, my hope, and certainly my command from the captain's chair that everybody who is in the situation of testing and of surgery, that you follow the instructions of your medical provider so that you leave the binnacle list in the captain's approved fashion. I will miss Brian a lot. He was a good man, and he was a good friend, and we had many, many interesting conversations together. And I think the biggest thing that we missed was that we were not able to spend nearly as much time from right between the running lights, and much of our relationship was by telephone and by email and things like that. One of his grandsons, by the way, is a graduate of West Point, is a artillery officer, and is training soldiers that are fighting in the Ukraine right this very minute. The good news from the West Coast is that I get once again to report that the blue whale situation is improving, because there are a number of shipping companies that have chosen to cut down their speed while they are in the Santa Barbara Channel, and in particular, the big blues are reviving and are being protected, and there is a formal recognition of all of that, and I'm always happy, and I think this is the third year in a row that I've reported that situation continues to improve. One of the things that I did with Sean and Barbie after my last broadcast was that we went to St. Paul's Cathedral in London. And there is a wonderful photograph. It's a wonderful only in the sense of its part photographic artistry. And also, it's a wonderful photograph because it speaks directly about the intensity of the British that they were not going to give in during the Battle of the Blitz. And it shows smoke and flame all around St. Paul's Cathedral. So we went to St. Paul's. Sean was concerned. He felt that it was inappropriate to have to pay admission to go into a church. But I pointed out to him that, like museum ships, these ancient buildings require an enormous amount of money and time and energy and engineering to keep them, to maintain them. A great example of that is Notre Dame in Paris and the terrible damage that came as a result of that fire and the enormous amount of time and energy and money that's going into the restoration. I'm going to talk more about Notre Dame in another broadcast. But we went into St. Paul's. We got Sean past the gate where you have to pay the pay a fee to get in. There is a sign that says that if you are here for a particular event, or if you are here just to meditate or to attend a service, then you don't have to pay. Sean and Barb and I were not there to meditate or to attend a service, and so we paid, and I paid happily because I know how much it costs to keep these things going. I had forgotten until we got into the building what a magnificent, magnificent building it is. And in particular for sailors, that you go down into the crypt, and down in the crypt is Lord Nelson. And right in the middle, underneath the dome, if you cannot look up because you would be looking up into the overhead, but right, it's under the big dome, the Christopher Wren dome that was built by designed by Wren after the 1666 London fire. And so Lord Nelson is down there, and then right next to him were Jellicoe and Beatty, Admirals Jellicoe and Beatty, both of them from the Battle of Jutland in the First World War, one of the definitive and defining battles of the First World War. And I had not known that they were there, and I just thought that it was so appropriate for a sailor to go down there and to be able to touch the place where Lord Nelson is resting his eternal rest, and right next to him is Jellicoe and Beatty. Nelson is of particular interest to me because his people thought very, very highly of him. He was, for the time and the age, he was a particularly enlightened commander. And there are some wonderful stories, biographies of him. And if you go to London, I urge you to make sure that you go to St. Paul's Cathedral and go ahead and pay the £20 or whatever it is. I don't remember. Pay that. Pay it cheerfully because you're helping to maintain it. And make sure that you go down into the crypt and see both where Nelson and Beatty and Jellicoe are buried. In the continuing story of the Bonhomme Richard, you will recall that I mentioned last time and the time before that that the young sailor who was charged both with arson and with hazarding a vessel, and that hazarding a vessel is an extremely serious one, and it's usually used for commanding officers who take chances with their ship that they should not do. this young man elected to be tried by a military judge alone, and I'm going to take a sip here. And he elected to be tried by a military judge alone. I thought that that was a sound decision on the part of himself and his defense counsel, and so it proved. He was found not guilty. And if I'd been the military judge, and of course I'm not qualified to be a military judge, I'm just a simple sailor who can barely read or write, I probably would have found him not guilty as well, because there was certainly not enough to overcome the reasonable doubt that the defense counsel put on. So that leaves, though, the accountability for all of the other people. And I go back once again to her captain. I'm sure, I know that he was relieved. I know that he will never command again. I know that he will not be promoted to flag. But so far as I know, he did not even go before a flag mast to be held accountable for his not having his ship ready to deal with the terrible calamity that overtook her. Every time I look at a photograph of her, the most recent one that I looked at, it brought tears to my eyes, because I had not seen one before that showed her with one of her masts toppled over. If there was ever an ultimate humiliation, it is that your top hamper has toppled over. And so I don't say that it's a wonderful thing that this young sailor was acquitted. What I do say is that the military justice system worked the way that it was supposed to work, and that what will happen to him, he's certainly not going to stay in the Navy. USS Nimitz. The Navy has a lot of trouble with fuel getting into water. The USS Nimitz, which is the lead ship in the Nimitz class of carriers, has had a problem with jet fuel getting into her potable water system. Now, I am not a snipe. A snipe is, in my vocabulary and in the vocabulary of all of Captain Joe's people who are shipboard engineers, are called snipes. But I don't understand how there is some cross connection between any fuel system and any potable water system. I don't see how it's possible for that to happen. Clearly, it is possible, because it did. And so Nimitz, for a while, looked like she might not be able to make her next commitment while they got it all flushed out. And now they think they've got it fixed, and they found where there was a cross connection. And having a little round of coughing there. So, but that ties in with the Red Hill situation. You all will remember that we've talked about that, where the fuel in the tanks at Red Hill in Hawaii, just down the hill from Tripler Army Hospital, and the Navy got into serious trouble about that. So that one is still underway. Now the Secretary of Defense himself is going out to Hawaii to try to placate everybody, get everybody settled down. It remains to be seen who is going to be held accountable for that. I know that the commanding officer of the Navy organization that included the fuel tankage at Red Hill was relieved, and that's a proper action. But it remains to be seen what else is going to be happening. The magazine for this week is the Navigator, and actually it is the Seaways, not Navigator, Seaways, the International Journal of the Nautical Institute, which is headquartered in London and of which I am a member. And there were a number of interesting articles in it this particular month. This is the September issue. And the one that I'm going to quote from is called the Roll Risk Eliminator. Now, we have talked before about containers being lost overboard, and in one case, one of the Maersk ships lost something like 2,000 containers overboard up in the Sea of Japan maybe a year and a half ago during the wintertime. And at that time, we talked about how they are clipped down on the eight corners. And if they're, of course, on top, then they're clipped down only by four corners. And no, get ready for this nautical term, no frapping lines or belly bands are put around the ones up on the top. So this role risk eliminator, the Maritime Research Institute of the Netherlands, has developed a role risk estimator as part of its top-tier project looking at container losses at sea, with particular focus on ultra-large ships. And what they have determined, and I could have told them this if they had thought to ask me, that a following sea can cause a kind of rolling, which is quite different from what you have from a beam sea, or one which comes if you are headed into it, or even with a quartering sea. And that roll can be pretty deep, and if the containers are not properly strapped down, then some of them are going to indeed go over the side. My point here is that I have before said a couple times that the Nautical Institute seems to me to be much more interested in the things like the roll risk estimator indicates combinations of speed, heading, and wave period that result in unfavorable tuning of roll motions that should be avoided. Well, of course they should be avoided. And I would think that any experienced captain would know how to avoid that. And one of the ways that we can avoid it is that we don't pile those containers up so high. But, of course, then we're talking about money. Anyway, we'll be talking more about that as well as a number of other things, because these are all things which are of interest not only to me as your captain up in the captain's chair, but also I know that they are of interest to you. And so I'm going to close today with a genuflection in the direction of the University of Stockholm and my Stockholm family, and in particular because a number of new doctors of philosophy, having graduated from the University of Stockholm under the supervision of my friend of family rank, Dr. Mark, have the photographs, glorious photographs of this whole thing have just come through to me. And so I, in this particular broadcast in Cleveland, next week I will be back on the magical Isle of Vashon, and I will be talking about things which are of interest and concern to all of us. I end this week, though, with a feeling of real sadness, and yet, as with Mary R., I have to be grateful, enormously grateful, that having known all of the Redmonds, and now two of the six of Maurice and Loretta's children are gone before their time, that that I would not have wanted to miss any of it. And if I had known what was going to happen and how it would have happened, I still would not have wanted to miss any of it. And that is family and our children and our grandchildren. All of these things, it is my hope and my wish that if you have children and grandchildren who are looking for a visit from you, that you will indeed go ahead and take care of that. So this is your Captain Joe, as always, up in the captain's chair, on station, and watching properly. And we never say goodbye. We say until we meet again. And this time we'll meet again once again on the magical Isle of Vashon next week. And many thanks to Counselor for engineering for me today. Everybody take care. Watch the six of those people for whom you are responsible and accountable. And that is my wish, my hope, and my command that all of us will be together next week right here from the captain's chair. Take care.